said entrepreneurship was easy.
But honestly, let's be real about it.
Hi, my name is Varun Balsara.
And I'm Luke Nellicliffe.
And we are the hosts of the Human Entrepreneur Podcast.
This is the podcast that unmasks the human behind the entrepreneurs.
We uncover the skills they have learned,
lessons they wish they knew earlier,
and stories that will motivate, inspire, and sometimes shock you.
Entrepreneurship just got real.
Welcome to our show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Human Entrepreneur Podcast. Today, Luke and myself are chatting with Pete Gooding. Pete is a club DJ, music producer, and a radio presenter. But way beyond any of the names and titles, he is a true music fan. When it comes to DJing around the world, it's fair to say that Pete Gooding has been there and done that. From residences at Ibiza's biggest clubs, including Pacha, Amnesia, and Privilege, to festivals like Bestival, Creamfields, Ibiza, At Space, and the 80,000 strong crowds at Stella Polaris Festival in Denmark. Today, Pete is chatting to us about his journey, how he chased his dreams, lessons learned along the way, and advice for aspiring artists slash producers. Welcome to the Human Entrepreneur Podcast, Pete. It's an absolute pleasure to be with you today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
You know, it's funny how we met, because we met at a yoga class in Bali in one of the resorts there. And, you know, we just got chatting. The next thing I know, I'm speaking to a very famous DJ who's actually playing at the resort there. And I start asking you all these stories, and here we are. So, Pete, been a long overdue conversation for us.
It's a pleasure to meet you and your parents. It's a beautiful place to do yoga, right?
Yeah. So, Pete, you know, when we ask, we ask all our guests on the Human Entrepreneur two things. So the first thing is, what is your elevator pitch?
Okay, I don't have one of those rehearsed. So I'm an artist manager. So my job is to inspire artists to, be their best selves so they can achieve their dreams in the music industry. Also, I have a music education business, and I'm still a hobby DJ just for fun now.
One other question that we ask is, what makes you human?
In what respect do you mean that? There's many different ways you can tackle that question.
Yeah, that's a good question. So what I mean to say is, when we talk about the human entrepreneur, we want to see the human being behind the fame, the success. And so what is that, a few things that actually make you human?
Discipline, to be honest. And it wasn't always this way, but discipline is everything. Your daily routine. You know, there's a great Aristotle quote I love, we are what we repeatedly do. And therefore, excellence is it's a daily routine. It's not an act. So really, it's how I plan every day, what I set out to achieve every day, and keeping sight of goals, bigger picture, and doing what inspires you most, because it's your best shot at doing a great job. You know, it's quite a straightforward thing to me that I see. I've always seen that. Maybe I can analyze it now. Now I'm a bit older, but when I was young, I just failed at things I was bad at. So, you know, I had no drive to do them, should I say, you know?
Yeah. When do you think that drive really started to kickstart within you?
My wife has a daughter, so my stepdaughter, and she's gone to really alternative schools all her life. In the school she goes to, you learn about things when you're ready. You know, in a mainstream school, you would have learned to read at an earlier age and you'd have had homework, whereas she has found a love for maths, a love for English, and it caters specifically to her. Whereas I went to school and I was dyslexic, but nobody picked up on it. So I was just thick. I was an underachiever. So school didn't serve me in that respect at that time. I was very, very good at athletics. So I became immensely competitive because I wanted to be good at something. And I felt like a failure in every single class. I moved house a year ago and I only started opening the boxes from when I was young, and I found all my school reports, and I was clearly incredibly distracted and really not very disruptive, but I was not engaged. And I think that's a failure of the school system for firstly not picking up. I was dyslexic, obviously, but the fact that then led me to believe I was an underachiever and a failure. But then, as I say, I found this sort of way of being incredibly motivated and winning at athletics. I failed all of my exams, all of them. It's actually, there's a funny story. I missed my business studies exam to buy a record that was released that week. My local record shop was called Don Christie's in Birmingham, and they were only going to get a handful of these records. It was by a guy called Frankie Knuckles, who invented house music. He's like the godfather of house music. And The track's called Your Love. It's like a huge classic. And I got to know Frankie very well years later. And my mother happened to be in Ibiza with me when we bumped into him. And my mother relayed the story to him. And I was DJing at the time at a place called Cafe Mambo. And I was in the DJ box. My mom was sitting there. And I had my copy, which I have here. And he signed, "Dear Pete, my friend, you made the right choice. Left Frankie." So I failed everything. And then I retook them for 3 or 4 years afterwards every year. And I kept failing and taking them again, but I just wasn't interested. And I was just wanting to be a DJ. And eventually my friend convinced me. Why was I even attempting to convince anybody I was academic and just come and get a job at the record shop and meet all the local promoters? For me, the biggest step, if I've ever taken a step that wasn't easy, and they're the kind of steps I deliberately make myself take now, but looking back, I thought if I was doing a bad job of being academic, but not really going for the DJing, I had an excuse for failure on both ends. Oh, well, I was trying to be a DJ. I couldn't give it my all. Or, oh, well, I was trying to study. It gave me a reason to fail, an excuse to fail. I was drawn so much to the thing I loved, I kind of just left in the middle of my studies and went and worked in a local record shop, which was the local in the city. It was the hub of activity from the industry and the scene. So I did that, and that was it, basically.
I honestly really appreciate this vulnerability, Pete, because you talk about failure in such a candid way, which I truly appreciate. I just want to pick your brain a little more on, the journey that you went through. And I think it's very hard to go through academic failure. You have a lot of judgment, family pressure, perhaps societal pressure. And you're right, education systems don't cater towards a specific individual, at least mainstream.
It doesn't have the time, does it? There's too many students in the class.
The question that I have to ask you is, when you took that step, what was going on firstly in your head? What was going on in your heart? And how did you kind of convince your family that this was it and this is what you want to do?
I deliberately make myself do things like this now, but I view things very differently. I am really proud that I made that choice, because it didn't look like the right choice on the surface to everybody around me. My father, he left school, got an apprenticeship. I mean, obviously he grew up in the 60s, got an apprenticeship. He did end up having his own business, but he couldn't understand that this thing I was doing, this DJing, was a job. And we always joked about me having a real job until I earned more money than him. And then I made a joke of it. I never wanted a job. That was the point. I never want a job. My mother, who is generally a very traditional, slightly uptight woman, who is very rigid in many ways, yet somehow was incredibly supportive. She could see I loved what I was doing and always supported me. So that must have made the choice easier. But I was so drawn to it, a bit like a magnet. It was kind of like I couldn't not do it. And, in reality, I wasn't consciously doing it. And maybe that made it easier. And when was that? It was the beginning of the 90s. I think if you're so drawn to something, you should be doing it. And you don't need to work out how it looks or, how are you going to earn money? You got to kind of worry about that afterwards. So I was just drawn to it. It definitely felt like a stressful, anxious situation, because it was like, oh God, I've got to make this work now, because I'm a failure academically. And actually at that time, DJing wasn't a job. It wasn't a career. Like the DJ in a club back then was like a geek who probably swept the floor afterwards. Not that there's anything wrong with doing that. I was actually the glass collector at the club I first DJed at. And I think I did still sweep the floor by choice after I'd finished DJing. But I just felt, oh my God, I think I was quite a hedonistic younger person, and it just looked like a lot of fun. I wasn't taking life that seriously because I hadn't bought into the academic system. Some of my best friends wanted to be lawyers. I wasn't grown up enough to make decisions like that. I just wanted to have fun. The choices I was making seemed to link to having fun. Quite quickly, when you're young, you surround yourself with people who often have the same views as you or interests, a bit like your initial group on social media, right? The way it groups people together. My behavior seemed perfectly acceptable to all the other DJs I started to then meet in the club promoters. It suddenly, I'd put myself in a circle where my behavior wasn't irresponsible. Once I'd made the choice, it was just the best fun.
Yeah, you raise a really good point, Pete, around like these group dynamics and how like switching from one to the other has all these like social norms and like how you should behave. We see it in like at university, like between students who may be interested in entrepreneurship and those who maybe are not interested in going down that path. Just the whole like it's a different mindset. And what is it about like music and the music industry that really draws you in?
It's a big thing now. Being a DJ is a clear, carved out career now, and you can earn tens of millions a year if you're very successful. So people aspire to this now. I just loved music. So my first memory of hearing a song was ABBA, Dancing Queen. I was on my way to a holiday with my grandparents, and I just remember that I acknowledged that was the first record I heard, and I've often broke down the ingredients. It was very melancholy. It was very dreamy and spacey with the kind of reverb on the vocals and the harps, that kind of those ingredients. And other records I heard a lot growing up were things like a band from Birmingham called ELO, again, amazing strings. Then I remember hearing a lot of Pink Floyd in the car, Phil Collins, and all the music I seemed to like was quite melancholy. I was quite drawn to melancholy music that sort of took me somewhere. I don't quite know what that would have been linked to. I mean, I've often thought about it, and my parents were getting divorced at that time. Maybe at that point that must, I don't remember this, but it can't have been easy for a three-year-old. It can't have been, or a four or five, you know, growing up through that. It must have been hard. And I was always playing and doing things that were very much in my own head. So I think I was always into stuff that took me somewhere else. I didn't have an unhappy childhood either. I had a great, great childhood, but I loved being in my head, and I loved music that created a mood and an atmosphere and made me think, or I always liked that kind of music. Yeah, music is an emotional connection is the point I'm trying to make. And I was so drawn to the emotional connection that was created hearing music. So it obviously had a profound effect on me, whereas, say, other things that had a profound effect on other people maybe just didn't resonate with me. It wasn't my purpose. My music was just such a draw. I mean, I remember thinking there was no clear career path. And I just remember thinking, however it is I feel when I'm working, or not working wasn't even the right word, when I'm listening to music is what I want more of this. It was just a draw to the feeling I got from music. So an emotional connection, whether you could argue that's some sort of spiritual thing or whatever you want to work. But I felt a very strong draw to the emotions I felt listening to the music I liked.
I mean, it seems like you're a very emotional person. You're in touch with your emotions. And I guess that's probably why you're producing great music. And I guess as an entrepreneur itself, I just want to, you know, I consider you an entrepreneur. That's probably why we're even having this conversation. You know, fundamentally, any musician creating something fundamentally is an entrepreneur. He's doing a lot of things that entrepreneurs would do in the conventional sense. One of the things that I'm really interested to see is, obviously, it's been tough. The journey has obviously not been easy. And I'm really interested to see, there are some great times and then there's some really low times. There's some dark moments. And those dark moments can either make you or break you. And I'm just wondering, what are some of the dark moments that have, you know, that have shaped you, and how have you gone through them?
I mean, I think at the time, the hardest moments you go through in life generally, you know, it's like a fight or flight response, I guess. They do, you know, when you're challenged, you can panic, you can have anxiety, you can become incapable of making decisions. When I was 13, my geography teacher, Mr. Napier, used to go off on lots of tangents in the class, asked us all what we wanted to do. And I felt a bit too embarrassed to give my answer. So I kind of just listened to everyone else's. I thought it might make me sound a little bit cocky. Everybody was putting their hands up with what seemed to me like mundane ideas about what they wanted to be. It's not to say they were mundane. They sounded mundane for me. They weren't inspiring to me. And I remember thinking, I just don't want to be like anybody in this room. I want to do something that has a real sense of adventure and where the amount of effort I put in relates to what I get out. That was quite a clear thought. I didn't know what that was ever going to relate to, having that thought. But the fear of being ordinary, in as I perceived ordinary, which was, again, it's a great thing to do for a living if you feel inspired so. But the Land Rover was where they make Land Rovers is a famous industry in Solihull. And a lot of people I knew went and worked there, and they would work there for their whole life on the track, putting on the same part. And again, if that's for you, fantastic. But it seemed so ordinary, and music made me feel so this kind of magical draw of, I didn't even know what it would resemble, but it felt quite a this amazing thing. And I, looking at the two, I was like, I can, like, life in Solihull seemed ordinary, mundane. The desires and goals of those around me seemed ordinary. Not that I even had a comparison. I was young at this point, but, and then listening to music felt so exotic and enticing. And I just wanted to feel like that. My motivation through my whole life was being, I never want a job. I never want to do things that don't inspire me. So that's why I work hard. It's why I've always worked hard. It's the fear of being ordinary. You know, ordinary is a perspective. My idea of exciting could be someone else's idea of ordinary. And what used to be my dream would now be my idea of hell.
But would you say that the inspiration you get is driven by fear, or is it driven by passion?
At moments it is, of course, because we all go, when things are difficult, you are affected by fear for sure. I mean, as I've got older, I've learned a lot of things that, of course, I didn't know. I'm trying to almost reflect on how I used to see it. No, I mean, I was just so drawn to things that really inspired me. And I'm really big on being inspired. It's always been something I've really been kind of into, the idea of feeling that when you're incredibly motivated and you have a high level of energy and you could focus on something for hours and hours a day and not even notice the time pass. I like that kind of a feeling when you're in the zone. So I was focusing on things that probably made me feel that way. So no, I think it was chasing a feeling of feeling inspired and having a purpose, being driven. That was what I was chasing. So again, subconsciously, I was very authentically drawn to these things. I hadn't done any sort of personal development till I was about 40. Like, it was a very instinctive thing, and it was so strong, it was just the thing I had no choice but to follow.
Yeah, I like how you say that, Pete, around, like, you're really chasing it because you were passionate, but also at times that fear of failure in a way did drive you when you needed it. And you also said, like, around creativity and, like, how you had those feelings when you're, like, I don't know, when you're creating music, I assume. What advice would you give to someone who maybe is just starting out, wants to start producing music? How can they get into, like, this creative zone that really helps them?
I think the common word is flow. It's getting into that flow, and I'm actually quite curious to know how you get there.
Well, basically, my most recent company, which launched 8 weeks ago, is an education company. Because I mean, basically, my career's been in stages, and I'll touch on some of the other bits, I'm sure, in other questions. But I left school and became a club promoter, and then to create a gig, because I didn't have one. So I thought, well, if I become a club promoter, I can create a gig. So I was a club promoter, a DJ. I was essentially a DJ for 20 years as a career. Then I've been a manager for the last 10 years. So I don't produce music anymore. And then 2 years ago, well, maybe 5 years ago or more even, I was on a plane and I was trying to work out how, as a manager, if you manage artists that are already established, you're not really going to get, not that you're looking for the credit, but you don't get acknowledged so much. It's when you break a new act with that artist, that's what people notice. And when my first artist had some success that we'd started from scratch on, I remember observing many traits in him that I wasn't seeing in my other artists. And then as I had other artists that were successful, I started noticing the same traits. So I started to write these down. I was just on a plane. I was terrified of flying all my life, like really scared. And sometimes I would fly 10, 12 times a week. And I started noticing all these traits. And then in Bali, I'd been meaning to write this stuff down and try and make a course out of it to help other people. And I was procrastinating, as I often do on most things in life. And then it just came out about 12 hours a day, day in, day out, for about 3 days. And I just wrote the journey of the artists I'd seen, my own, and all my friends who had been really successful. So I suppose it's a bit like a Napoleon Hill version of the development of a DJ. I had this goal, which I wrote down in Bali, and it was, I want to create the world's number one artist development course. I want to partner with a school called Point Blank, because I researched with the best school in the world, music school. All over the world, they have them. So that was my goal. And then a week later, I'm in Hong Kong, randomly bump into a guy I've not seen for 20 years who asked me what I'm up to. I tell him, and he says, oh, you should talk to Rob, who owns Point Blank. I'm friends with him. What that guy didn't tell me was he just bought the franchise for China. But then I met Rob. He loved the idea, and we partnered. So we've ended up, I was starting to teach in May, But obviously with COVID, I couldn't. So we had to create it as an online course, which launched 7 weeks ago. And essentially, the course is based around those exact principles, because there isn't a formula that suits everybody. Otherwise, you know, major labels like Sony and Universal would have success with every release. They've got the funds, they've got the knowledge. So basically, it was trying to put into words, and it was hard because I thought about it for about 5 years, but how to put into words how to help people. And really, it comes down to this, I think. People perceive other people to have talent. You might see somebody who's very good at something and think they're really talented, or maybe they were born with the ability to do that. And somebody challenged my idea about what talent actually was. And I've now resigned to the fact that if you find the thing that is your purpose or that you're most inspired by, you naturally will work incredibly hard at it. Like when I bought my decks, I played on them 10 hours a day. I had blisters on my fingers trying to learn to scratch. And I did it day in, day out. Not because I was trying to be good at it. I felt the need to do it because I felt good while I was doing it. So essentially, it's authenticity. And not that I knew that at the time, but I try and push people to be authentic, to not look at the route that they think will take them directly to money, but the one that is the most fulfilling, the one that will have them work 15, 16 hours a day every day if they have to, and not feel they're working. Because if you find the thing that inspires you most, you're kind of giving your highest contribution, and that leads to talent. Because if you repeatedly do something, you get very good. So that creates your talent that others perceive as talent. So it's finding what drives you most. And again, for creativity, I think you've got to create time and space to do it. You know, if you want to specifically, again, and I've had to study this a lot, I've read a lot of books on this, and if I give myself 6 hours to be creative, I'll procrastinate because I've got time to procrastinate. So a shorter block of, say, an hour and a half, something like that, phone off, put yourself in a position where you will not get distracted, so you can get into that zone or into that flow and really connect with what it is that you're wanting to do, and you get great results. Because that is, you know, essentially your higher consciousness, or whatever you would want to call it, you're tapping into that.
Now, I know this is going to be a slightly controversial topic, and you've probably been asked this a bunch of times, but do you think any sort of psychedelics or any sort of substance helps you or has helped you in the past to create or boost that creativity?
I mean, for me, again, I can only answer effectively as a 40, well, I'm 47 tomorrow, but as a 46-year-old, I'm going to cling to being 46 one more day. I took, you know, as all people in the town I grew up in, everybody took drugs. It was 1990. The rave scene was beginning, 1989. So at that time, I took LSD, I took mushrooms, ecstasy, you know, whatever else everybody was doing. I mean, that was probably pretty much it within reason. And but I haven't taken any drugs at all for about 27 years. I don't even drink. When I stopped drinking about just over 3 years ago, because I had arthritis in my knee, it was a huge game changer. The clarity of being much more connected with yourself, I think, allows you to tap into it far, far better.
Could you elaborate on that a little more?
For me, lifestyle is the key to everything, in the sense of my daily ritual, which is quite rigid, to be honest. It's very rigid, in fact, by the end. When my assistant sees my diary, she's like, wow, you've even got 15 minutes in there to have a shower. You've got, like, it's all, my life is planned on a daily basis with extreme attention. I think having a great routine, for me, health and wellness, if you eat very well, you exercise, you're motivated, you're up, you know, a good routine creates the opportunity for creativity, as I see it as a 46-year-old. I spend a couple of hours at least a day in nature. We live in the middle of nowhere. Like the view from every room in our house is beautiful. For me, that's huge. Like being in nature creates space to think as well in itself. You know, I walk my dog 3 times a day in awe-inspiring, beautiful views, being on top of these volcanic tours where you can see for miles and miles. We can see the sea from here. It's a very deliberate thing. You know, I lived in Ibiza for many years. I only left Ibiza a year ago. It wasn't coincidental. I've lived in beautiful places. I find them very inspiring. So for me, your surroundings, your daily routine, your lifestyle creates the results you have. You know, for me, that's where it brings me back to the word discipline. It's all in there, you know.
It's super interesting you saying that, Pete, because you said earlier around, it's like, the people you surround yourself with that influences you. And now it's sort of like also the places and like the routine that you surround yourself with, I guess, that also has a massive effect. Now we want to talk a bit about more about the music industry. How did you find it? Was there like this like dark side of the music industry that no one wants to talk about? Or is it something that you enjoyed throughout your life? How did you find it?
Personally, I had a great time. I've been really lucky though. So maybe I've never felt resentful. I think in all industries, people are often can be very bitter if they didn't make it, or and it's a tough thing, you know, to have any success is quite rare. And real success is incredibly rare. So for me, yeah, I mean, obviously there is a dark side to the music scene and industry in that there's a lot of drugs. Generally, there always has been, you know, however far you want to go back.
Why is that so, though?
I guess drugs, music, and transcendence go well together. You know, people have done that for thousands of years. Tribes around the world are going back a long time. It's a natural thing, I think, to sort of seek transcendence, isn't it? And I'm not suggesting it is actually the best way. Now I'm older and I've got a more boring answer. But, you know, at the time, it was escapism and that was fun. So bad behavior does not stand out in the music industry. I remember coming home and explaining to some of my friends how much I drank and what time I went to bed every day when I was a DJ in Ibiza in my 20s. And they were kind of quite horrified. And, you know, you are a result of the people you spend most of your time with. So I think people say often, you know, be very careful who the five people are around you most are. And, you know, at that time, there were club promoters, other DJs. I mean, that's the lifestyle that is often, doesn't have to be. But in that era was there. Now it's way more sensible.
I read somewhere that you were doing like Padilla, you were doing like 9-hour sets, 7 nights a week. How are you like sustaining that? And like, what did that have like long-term negative effects that you felt? Or
yeah, I mean, also let's be realistic. I was doing something I was totally in flow in for 9 hours a day. I mean, that's a pleasure. I was incredibly drunk most of the time, but also that may have created even more so of that. But yeah, you know, other people do real jobs that they hate, so it's a lot easier than that. But if I look back to that era, so that's the mid-90s, I would wake up at 6 p.m. with a bad hangover. I would roll down to Cafe Mambo for 7. I would probably feel pretty rough because we were young and partying every day. I mean, in the summer, you partied every day. You know, also I was working 9-10 hours a day at Mambo, but then I had residencies in other clubs afterwards. And then on a Thursday night, I would work at Mambo, then maybe another club, and then go straight to the air, go home, change my bag, straight to the airport, and then fly 10 flights around Europe doing Friday night, Saturday night. So yeah, Friday and Saturday night, land just in time to jump in a cab and race to Mambo, sweating, thinking, am I going to get there? And just in time to race in and start another 10-hour set. And that was 22 weeks non-stop. We drank a hell of a lot. Thankfully, at that point, I'd stopped taking drugs years before. But yeah, you know, I mean, looking back, it's terrifying. I mean, I don't even drink now.
Would you be able to do that right now? Like,
I wouldn't choose to.
Why not?
Because I love feeling great. And I analyze so much how I plan my life and to get the results I want and to feel very sort of present and enjoy what I do. I'm not going to get that if I'm hungover. And also the results I wanted weren't really possible in the end, but it served me at that time. I had a great time and no long-term damage was done, thankfully, but I just had a great time and it was very much accepted behavior. You know, being drunk, you're encouraged to be drunk in your job. You know, that's an unusual scenario, isn't it? To, you know, you go to work and the people you are working for are encouraging you to get drunk, possibly even trying to give you drugs. You know, it's like, it's very normal. It just became totally normal. So, but the music industry doesn't have to be. It's how you want it to be. You have control over your actions.
But do you know people who haven't like had drugs and still done really well with like music and...
Yeah, for sure.
I've always wondered this, and I don't know, I've had a lot of conversations with Luke about this offline as well. It's like, you know, many of the times there's this thing called microdosing that's taking place even within the entrepreneurship circuit. I'm not saying everybody does it, but, you know, that is just enough to, you know, give you that creative boost and stuff like that. And I was like, Wait, so you're saying all successful people do this, or are there people who are successful but don't have to rely on this to, you know, get there? And I guess there's this huge debate going on, but I was wondering what you thought, especially in the music industry.
Microdosing and being an entrepreneur, which of course I've encountered people in that world who do that, that's a very different thing to just getting smashed every day. Like, that's a deliberate thing. However, personally, I don't have a problem with other people doing it. I wouldn't do it. I love doing everything very naturally, and I have for years. So that's not for me. But whatever works, as long as it's, you're aware of whether it is or isn't damaging you. I mean, you know, I'm sure to some people it's just an excuse to keep, you know, to keep doing. But then I know people that do it and they don't appear to be in any different state. You know, they just, but they've had incredible levels of creativity. I have seen that. So I've seen that work. One of my old business partners was doing that, and a very creative person indeed. I mean, surprisingly so. So yeah, I think it can definitely be very effective. But you don't see microdosing in the music industry. That's for people who are really thinking about what they're doing and being very specific on results. The music industry is about, there's generally people getting smashed, and it, you know, there's a very hedonistic side of music in the music industry, and I think it draws people who are like that. It doesn't draw people who are interested in microdosing and trying to get the right results. People are partying and having fun, and they're not, in my experience, they're not viewing it that way. So I don't think everybody has their daily rituals, their habits, and whatever yours are, either do or don't serve you to whatever degree that you can acknowledge.
Can you be like a, you know, you're like a new musician, get, you know, breaking in, doing your thing. Would you be accepted into like the musical fraternity if you don't do the and the alcohol? Do people respect that?
Well, people of your generation, for example, are far more sensible. I don't see the bad behavior as the norm anymore in younger people, which is amazing. You know, they're just a bit, I think we were just weren't the smart, but yeah, you know, I to give you an example, when I stopped drinking, I was managing artists, and I remember being in a club, Amnesia in Ibiza, and another manager friend of mine saying, "Oh, do you want a drink?" And I said, "Oh, I don't drink." And he was like, "Oh, come on." And then some of the other friends we were with, maybe they were DJs, were literally all taking the piss, essentially. And I remember the next day thinking, do I want to be the boring dad DJ that isn't going to fit in? And I really worried about it. A clear conclusion came to me as an older, wiser person. And it was actually, my artists are with me because I am that. And you can own that and go, you know what? They want me because I get up at 5 a.m., because I've got my shit together, because I'm not talking shit in a club, partying all night. If they can do that, that doesn't need to be my job. So I became very comfortable with that. I could imagine there would be a lot of pressure when, for me as a younger person thinking that way, not that I tried to think that way when I was younger, because I probably didn't have the self-realization to even understand that process of thinking that through. You know, for me, being older is an amazing thing. The older I get, the more I love it, the more confident you are in your own opinion. You don't need other people's approval. I mean, it's a wonderful gift, because when I was young, and when a lot of people are young, you are more impressionable, and it makes those choices harder. I'm sure, because DJing was my dream, and I never dreamed it would go as far as it did. So in theory, I was living the dream. But looking back, I'm actually way happier now than I ever was when I was doing any of the things I've done.
If you have to kind of summarize like your mistakes into like the top three that you'd probably advise someone not to do, what would those top three be in the music industry?
I mean, the biggest mistake people make is playing safe and trying to fit in. You must stand out. To do that, you have to be bold, and you have to be prepared to get it totally wrong. Because if you fit in, I mean, essentially, if an artist came to me and wanted to be like a lot of other people with no, you know, a derivative of what they're already aspiring, looking at, then they'll have some degree of success relatively quickly, and they'll feel like they achieved something initially. But real success, as I call real success, is a long-term career. You need to stand out, and you need to take chances. It's kind of, in my opinion, it's riskier not to take a risk. Don't be a derivative of what's out there. That's the biggest thing. You know, if you look at the artists, the great artists that maybe inspired people more than others, you know, the David Bowies, the Princes, whatever, they were not derivatives of what was out there. They were in their own right something. And that's why they inspired people, you know. So do not fit in. Do not be a derivative of what's there is the biggest piece of advice I would give. And, you know, if you're not prepared to work incredibly hot, long hours doing something you love, then again, it's not for you. So, you know, be prepared to give up things, make sacrifices. If you're not prepared to make sacrifices, that's another point you're going to fail. You've got to be prepared to put it first. So if that is going to get in the way and you're going to duck out at that point, then it's not for you, you know. Embrace getting it wrong, because you need, if you just be what you think you need to be and copy other people, you can't present anything that's going to really inspire an audience. So you can't expect to stumble across that straight away. Be knowing it's okay. I mean, again, failure was not a celebrated thing when I was young, right? You failed at a test was wrong. Now I don't view it that way. You failing is teaching you something, right? People who are really good at stuff have failed more times than you've probably ever tried if you haven't achieved that yet, because it's natural, right? So embracing failure is probably the overarching thing of all of it. It's great to fail, but I guess, again, younger people grow up much more likely to know that, with all of the resources and the fact that the access to information that people now have, it's easy to find these things out now. It was impossible in the 80s and the 90s. So being open to failing and getting everything wrong, because you'll learn from it, you know, it's the most valuable thing.
Yeah. And you say like access to information is just, it's abundant now. We can like connect with everyone around the world. But at the same time, with this change in technology, we've had like the rise in like music streaming. We've got like Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube have helped change the music industry. Has your advice changed, or do you think it's different for people just starting out now, trying to break into the music industry? What advice would you give them?
It's essentially the advice that the course is built around, and again, I can't say it's a definitive answer. It's the most definitive answer I've seen. And I've interviewed, you know, nearly 100 people to get their comments, and those interviews will continue. But it's having a unique selling point in multiple areas. It's different now to how it was when I did it. It was enough to just be a DJ when I was young. You didn't need to do anything else. Now you need a unique selling point in your, if you are a DJ or maybe you're a band, but a unique selling point in your performance. A unique selling point in the music you make, a unique selling point in your image. And again, I don't mean that you need to be good looking and slim. I mean, you need an image, you need a look, you need something that will resonate. And then a USP in your story and how you're projecting it. And again, you don't need some elaborate story. Your story is your story. It's just owning it, you know. You've got to be able to own what you are, who you are, and project it confidently, boldly, and again, take chances. So you're looking for a USP in all multiple areas.
Seems more like, you know, the brand is as important as the work and the craft that you do. I mean, what are the barriers to entry for a musician? There's literally nothing right now. You can literally just record and put it up on Apple Music or Spotify, and that's it, right? So I guess the differentiator probably is also in the way you market yourself and brand yourself.
So yeah, so the music industry is about association. It always has been. As a new artist, you need to associate with some positive things that are going to allow you a bigger reach. So, you know, for me, you know, build a body of work, create, again, I hate the word brand when it comes to music. It feels so corporate. However, it's sadly the way it is now. I don't even sadly, it is what it is. There's no point in denying what is, it is. So yeah, being aware of that, you know, when I was a DJ and learning to be a DJ, you know, 30 years ago, I just needed to be good at choosing records. Now you need to be a marketing expert, a content creation expert, a record producer, which is a whole different career on its own, a DJ, and many, many other things. And you've got to be a one-stop shop for all of this. You've got to be multitasking across all of these things in the beginning. Because, of course, in the beginning, you're trying to really light a spark to become visible. You're trying to, you know, set your career on fire, as it were. You're trying to create this buzz. And once you do, you can attract a team, and then other people can come in and take those roles from you and allow you to grow. But yeah, you know, you You've got to identify what it is about yourself that is unique. And a lot of people feel quite disempowered about, you know, you can empower the idea that successful artists are this complete, wonderful package with a great story, but actually you are as well. The only thing you're going to do better than anyone else is being yourself, right? It's a very basic fact. Like, you know, if you pick someone like Calvin Harris, who's obviously immensely successful, the world doesn't need a second-rate Calvin Harris copy because they've got Calvin Harris. But what they do need potentially is who you are. So you've got to understand who you are, be empowered about projecting that confidently in a way that resonates with you, that's authentic, whether that be through your music, your content, your performance, your story, the way you communicate. And when you can own that authentically, confidently, then you're giving your highest contribution. That's your best chance of standing out. That I can directly say, yeah, you need to be on this label or that label, but they're looking for individuals who are confident, have something unique, and are being bold. So it may sound like it's not a direct answer, but it is a direct answer. You know, you could say, get on this label, get on that label, play at that club, but you can't do those things without a great product. And how do you make a great product? By being inspired, by doing what's authentic, by owning who you are confidently, not being a derivative of what's there.
I guess just want to challenge that, you know, because I agree, authenticity is so key and being your individual, you know, person is amazing. But do you think a large part of that has to be with like luck and the idea of luck? Because what if someone, like you're being authentic, but not many people like you, and, you know, and that's that. And versus someone else who's being authentic and being himself and like everybody likes him. Wouldn't you agree that there's some amount of luck, and how much of that luck plays out for artists?
Yeah, again, you know, if you look back, the older you are, the more time you have to observe this on. But every tiny choice you make leads to what happens next, and on it goes. So if I hadn't have, you know, missed my business studies exam, just one tiny act would have affected everything that's happened since, right? So you make your own luck because you make your own choices. So make informed choices that resonate with you. And it's not going to take you anywhere different than where you were going to go, but at least be aware of the choices you are making. Because, you know, again, without being, you know, I read my goals on a daily basis, and it is alarming how they keep coming, they keep happening. But I mean, to the letter, it's bizarre. But I focus on what I want. So I try and create what I want every day. So because you're going to create something every day based on the choices you make, whatever it is you do with your life, you're very deliberate and on purpose about those choices and how you spend your time. It will take you to where you're meant to be. You just need to decide what area you want that to be in.
Like you said, it's also about the choices you made.
One of the questions I have in my interview that I've been asking the artists, and if I apply it to myself without sounding a bit sort of harsh, I never went to any of my friends' weddings, pretty much. It's very rare if I ever did. I never went to a single stag do. I was never around for Christmas. I spent sometimes 8 months of the year out of the country, so totally neglected any girlfriends. You know, I neglected everything to have what I wanted. To me, that wasn't a sacrifice because I wanted more the thing I was chasing. So it wasn't a sacrifice to not be a great boyfriend. Unfortunately, at that time, I was so drawn to music. It wasn't a sacrifice to miss my best friend's stag do. It was too exciting to do what I was doing. I just didn't see anything else. I was very single-minded about doing that. So, but they're only sacrifices if it's not what you're meant to be doing. They won't feel like sacrifice.
Like, looking back, would you change any of that?
No, my God, no. No, not at all. The thing is, I did well as a DJ, and I surpassed any goal I had as a DJ. I mean, I wasn't big on setting goals then. I was just happy to be doing what I was doing. Looking back, I could have taken my DJing a lot further. Now I know what I know as a manager, but then I'm happy that I'm able to help other people far more than I would be being more of a self-absorbed artist who maybe had thought how wonderful he was because he was so successful. Instead, it kept me in a very with a humble perspective, and I've been to be able to help a lot of other people be unstuck where I was totally stuck. I made huge mistakes in my music career, which is, of course, I think we're often driven to create solutions for things we failed at. And I love the idea to try and help artists take the right path and zoom in on who they are and what they want to be and empower them to make the right choices. I kind of went with the flow, and that's fine. I had a great career. I'm really proud of it, but it could have gone a lot further. But now I've got this other career, which I love even more, you know? So being a manager, having this education business, I love that even more. And I DJ for a hobby.
How important do you think work-life balance is? Because obviously you sacrifice a lot of this, so maybe that didn't come first in your pathway. What have you observed from your reflection?
It's a big thing that people talk about. You know, you get people like, you know, Gary Vee, for example, who's the marketing guy, obsesses about how you must work 18 hours a day or more. He's obviously successful. I know people that have worked with him, you know, who I work with now. And, he, you know, guy's a machine. That works for him, maybe. It will not always work for him. Even, you know, because killing yourself is not actually productive in the end. It's not, you know. And I think entrepreneurs seem to see that as almost like it's something to be proud of, that you overwork. And it's like cool. I bet in entrepreneurial circles, which I've never considered myself to be one, by the way. I just somebody who does what he likes. I never use that term. But again, it's a very fashionable term in itself, right? So it feels, but it seems that entrepreneurs seem to aspire to this idea that you've got to kill yourself. But when you do something you love, you can't help but do that. So you almost have to enforce a balance in. At that time, I knew no balance whatsoever. I was massively overdoing it. I was not getting the sleep. My sleeping patterns were horrendous. But it worked for me in my 20s in the sense that I survived it. But now I'm very specific. So I can answer as a 46-year-old. I'm very specific about it. You know, I have a rule. I never, ever have less than 7 hours sleep anymore. I just don't do it because I've been there. Even two years ago, we were in between houses in Ibiza for 4 months. We went to Bali the year before we met, and my wife and daughter stayed on for 4 months because my wife wanted to build her new business and she wanted the space to think about that. And we love Bali. So I actually went and stayed at my mom's in Solihull, and I had no wife and child at that point. So I worked at least 16, 18 hours a day, every day, 7 days a week for 4 months. But then I felt quite depressed, which is not me at all. I had extreme fatigue, anxiety, and I was Googling it, and it was adrenal fatigue or burnout, people call it. So licorice tea, magnesium, and putting a two-hour cycle into the countryside in my day fixed it within days. And I noticed if I then reverted back, it came back. So it became clear that, and I would have been 44, 45 at the time, that you do need a balance. And you know, for example, I mean, maybe even a quick summary of my rough daily routine for me, because that is my answer in a way, is that I get up at 5 and I meditate. I would say every day. It's rare. If I don't meditate, it's because I chose to do some yin yoga, what we were doing when we met. That's a daily thing. And that's done around 5 in the morning. And then I will work on something very specific between, say, 6 o'clock and breakfast, that I would normally procrastinate over, finance or something that's boring. Or so I make myself do that, which now I'm in a rhythm and loving it. Then I will go for a walk in nature, somewhere with a huge view that's beautiful, and I will listen to an audiobook about something specific. And then I'll work for, say, a block of 3 hours, and I'll go walking again, listen to a different audiobook. Then I'll, again, eating the right food. And then obviously we have dinner, and then I'll have, again, lots of breaks in between the day. And then I finish at a very specific time. And then I deliberately will choose something to wind down from working. So ideally without a screen. So it might be, you know, attempting to play my guitar really badly, or reading a physical book, or, you know, sometimes it might be, you know, just watching a documentary in the bath. Or but then I'll meditate again when I go to bed and then sleep. And that's, so for me, it's meditating, it's the right food, it's the right amount of sleep, and being very focused on specific goals. Like I plan every day. Actually, my wife bought me a Brendan Burchard book. It's called The High Performance Planner. If you know it, you do. I've adapted it to my own life, so I've changed a bit of it, but I do that every morning. And then I check in every night. Then I do a weekly review, which is today. I do it on a Sunday. Then I collate the weekly reviews, obviously, into a monthly review. But then I do the monthly reviews into blocks of quarterly reviews. And then I do an annual review every year at Christmas, normally in Bali. And I really think for a few days on what worked, what didn't, what did I fail at, what did I learn from, you know, all of the outcomes that you need to observe. And I make sure every day I focus a little bit, again, the Aristotle saying, we are what we repeatedly do. I love that. You know, what did I repeatedly do today that is part of my bigger picture? Because if I didn't do something every day that relates, of course, there are things I have to do every day that are not my ultimate bigger picture, but also doing, embracing those as well. So for me, it's about lifestyle, how you plan, how you prepare, so that you can be creative, so that you can give your highest contribution and do your best at what you do, so you feel the most fulfilled in what you're doing. I'm a very happy person. I love every day. Obviously, every person has challenges and nobody gets off free, right? The end of story. But I see benefits and drawbacks in everything. If something bad happens, there's a great thing in there. If good things happen, there's some sort of restriction in there. You know, you can get a huge new client, and then you'll neglect other things because you'll be so busy. Maybe that client will leave you. So getting that client, there's a huge drawback potentially. Not getting that client is, I mean, somebody taught me this. It was a personal development course I was on, but I was about to sign an artist to Sony, and he was saying, well, what's the drawback of that? I'm like, there is no drawback. If I could sign this artist to Sony, of course it's amazing. And he said, right, write me a list of 25 things that are drawbacks of getting the deal. And I'm like, I was stuck. He helped me. I was there for an hour and I wrote the list. Then he went, right, now, so you've got the drawbacks of getting the deal. Now, what are the benefits of not getting the deal? And I'm like, there are no benefits of not getting it. He went, yes, there are. And I'm like, okay, same again. And I apply that process to everything. But I do it mentally very quickly in my head now. But there are benefits and drawbacks to everything. Acknowledging that is a huge step in itself. What that does is makes you fearless in your decision making, right? You're going to fail at many things. There are benefits and drawbacks to everything. So as of knowing that, you may as well just do what you want to do.
I've been a huge fan of meditation. I've seen the benefits of it. I think Luke is beginning to see them. I personally feel like when we're talking about the creativity and all of that, I think it does boost your creativity. There's a lot of evidence suggests that as well. So I guess, yeah, I kind of get where you're coming from with the whole meditation. I completely respect and understand that. And yeah, thanks so much for sharing your journey. I mean, before we move on to the very, very last segment of our conversation, I just wanted to ask you, if you have to give like three things that you would want, you know, few young entrepreneurs, which is primarily our audience, to understand, what would they be?
Yeah, because you can't give advice on what they should specifically focus on because you don't know them and what they want. So for me, I mean, again, it only works for me, so I can only recommend on what has worked for me. I can't, you know. I would say, it's going to sound possibly really boring, but being incredibly healthy, so a great diet. Now, a great diet means different things to different people. But, you know, we've gone through phases up and down, but cutting right back on or getting rid of eating meat in the sense that, you know, when your body's not spending its whole time digesting, you are way more energized and less lethargic. So diet is essential, you know, super healthy organic food, if you can get your hands on it, if you can afford that. But I think the healthier you can eat and being aware of what's in the food, you know, why is it great to eat? So, you know, let's call it an understanding of nutrition and how it relates to results. So nutrition, self-care, whether you want to call that meditation, getting the right amount of sleep, and being in nature, for me, it's those things. So it's lifestyle. It's absolutely essential.
When we do end our podcast, moving to the final segment, we always ask our guests what the first thing they do in the morning and what the last thing they do before they go to bed. And you've already answered those questions. So
it's fashionable now to say you meditate, right? I think wellness is a more accepted thing, you know.
More like how yoga has become like a technique for losing weight or something like that.
And, you know, if that works for you, it's fine. But obviously, I mean, I'm really into spirituality and I read about it a lot. So I totally get the connection to it, but it's, I really do it, you know, I'm sure because it's fashionable, a lot of people say they do, you know, I love doing it, you know, and it is a great way to start your day. And even just breathe, you know, even in the middle of the day, just taking time out to really breathe and having just a gap for 2 minutes, it sort of refreshes everything, you know? So I think it's a huge factor.
You think like if you didn't like meditate or something, if you discovered meditation before, would you kind of have worked your music career differently?
No, you know what? The current me could give the 23-year-old me all the best tips in the world. I'd think I was a boring old fart and I shouldn't listen to myself. I wasn't ready for it. You know, everything turns up when you're ready for it in life, right? And you can't wish things, you weren't ready for it. I wasn't ready to even contemplate any of the things I now understand until I was able to contemplate them. I really got into personal development like 5 years ago. I wasn't ready for it until then. I wouldn't have absorbed it. It wouldn't have been appealing. It wouldn't have resonated with me. So no.
I love that. So, Pete, we're just going to ask you some quick fire questions to wrap it up. So you ready?
Yep.
What's your favorite book?
If it's one, but my God, that's so hard. Let me think. Maybe Michael J. Singer, The Untethered Soul. It's one of them. Rich Dad, Poor Dad's another brilliant one, though.
And your favorite podcast?
I don't listen to any specific ones all the time, but I do like listening to Joe Rogan occasionally. I listen to different property podcasts. I listen to many different ones, but I don't religiously listen to anybody's consistently.
And what's your favorite song?
I don't know. If I was on an island and I could only take one album, it might be Frank Sinatra's Greatest Hits. I never get bored of listening to Frank.
And what's your favorite song that you've produced?
I tend to not like my own music that much, but because it seems so ordinary to me. But I think I had an act called No Logo with a friend of mine, and we did a track called Forever, which is like a Latin jazz record, which I love.
And what's your favorite movie?
I mean, historically growing up, it would have been like Star Wars back in the sort of 70s and 80s. I loved that. We don't own a telly, so I haven't watched telly for years. So I'm probably massively out of the loop of what goes on the TV. But growing up, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, I was always really into fantasy stuff. I was always into.
And my final question is, what's one word that describes you?
One word that describes me, my God. Adventurous.
I love that.
Pete, thank you so much for this and, you know, really appreciate it. I'm sure, you know, our audience is going to get so, so, so much value from this. Honestly, thanks for your time and we're really, really appreciative.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to our podcast. If you enjoyed it, drop a review wherever you're listening to this. And for weekly content, subscribe to our podcast channel. And for more updates, check our social media channels attached in the show notes below. Thank you very much.